Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us This Week in America, coast to coast, website thisweekinamerica.us. It's called Baseball Magic, the new released book, Off-Speed Baseball Pitching and the Art of Deception, a lively, fascinating story of baseball's 150-year hunt for the perfect pitch by acclaimed journalist and best-selling author Terry McDermott. August 15th, 2012, Felix Hernandez of the Seattle Mariners pitched a perfect game against the Tampa Bay Rays in what Terry calls one of the greatest exhibitions of off-speed pitches ever put on. Using that framework of that remarkable game, 9 chapters, 9 innings, 9 pitches, he traces the history and evolution of pitching and the pitcher's art of deception, approaching the subject with the love every fan brings to the ballpark along with probing investigative journalism. Terry is a lifelong fan and student of the game, a former national reporter for the LA Times, author of 3 previous books, including The Hunt for KSM, Inside the Pursuit and Takedown of the Real 9/11 Mastermind, co-authored with Josh Meyer, 101 Theory Drive, The Discovery of Memory, and The 9/11 Hijackers, Who They Were, Why They Did It, described by the Washington Post as the definitive book on the 19 men who brought such devastation and terror to this country. And now Off-Speed, Baseball Pitching and the Art of Deception, author Terry McDermott with us on This Week in America. Terry, welcome to the program. It's great to have you with us today.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
This is an excellent book. Off-Speed is described as being at the intersection of new school data and old school romance. Let's start with the old school romance. You grew up in a small town in Iowa, Cascade. What impact did that What impact did that town and your dad have on this lifelong love affair with baseball?
Well, our town only had 1,200 people in it, and nobody famous had ever come from there except for one guy, Red Faber, who was a Hall of Fame, the last legal spitball thrower in the majors. So baseball was always a popular sport there, and we didn't even have football or anything like that. We had a baseball team and basketball, and that was it. And in the Midwest, as you might know, every little town had its own team, not a high school team, but a semi-professional team.
Yes.
Anybody from 15 to 50 could play. And they played, sometimes they played 60, 70 games in a summer. So it was always baseball going on. And my dad was the general manager of the team. So his job, in addition to his real job, he was a mailman. But his job for the team was to make sure that they had enough players every night, to make sure that the field was in good conditions, which meant that I was at the field all day long. He wasn't. I was there taking care of the field, cutting the grass, breaking up the dirt, all that kind of stuff. So I spent as much time in ballparks as I did in schoolrooms when I was a kid. Couldn't get away from it. It started there and never really left. I kind of fell out of being a fan for a while when I was I left home when I was 17.
Right.
And for several, I went to, ended up in Vietnam, and for several years there, I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. But then I grew up listening to it on the radio, like a lot of people did.
Exactly.
And that the sound of baseball on the radio is something that never leaves my head. You know what I mean? It's got this sort of ritualistic sound to it. It's like being at a Latin mass almost. And when I moved to Seattle in the middle 80s, and they had a great play-by-play guy up there from rural Indiana. His name is Dave Niehaus, who's now in the Hall of Fame.
Yes.
So I started listening to Niehaus. The team was terrible, but he was great, man. He was just so good. He had this voice that would just kill you. He smoked and he drank. little craggy voice, but boy, by the time you get laid into a game, you're just red in the flow of it. And I just fell in love with the game all over again, just listening to Niehaus.
It's interesting. Yeah, as you listen to a game, there's almost a certain rhythm, isn't there? They talk a little bit. You can hear the crowd in the background. There's silence, which you don't often hear on a sports broadcast. It had its own rhythm to it, and its own cadence.
Yeah, there's... The novelist Mark Harris said that back in the 50s when you listened to it on the radio, he said even time was slow.
Yes, yes, it exactly.
Really was. There's a sort of rustic quality to it in a way, or at least in our memories of it. And that's so every time I hear it, if I go on a trip somewhere in a car, I look for baseball games. I don't care if it's a minor league game or some team I hate. I don't care. I just want to listen to the game. It's such a gentle. It seems like an innocent thing. You know what I mean? It's like it comes from a long time ago.
Yeah, and you get a chance to escape as you're listening to the game. And as you grow up and you listen, you dial the old AM radio and you're listening to games, you really didn't even know some of the players. You just wanted to listen to the game. Terry McDermott is our guest on the program, author of the book Off Speed, Baseball Pitching and the Art of Deception. The book's available all across the country. And like so many of us, you were introduced to sporting news at an early age, thanks to Jake's Barbershop. I remember when I first discovered sporting news, that literally turned my life around. I could not wait for that to arrive, and you could go through basically the box score of every game played in both leagues the previous week.
Yeah, it's like, I'm a big Lord of the Rings fan. Did you ever see the Lord of the Rings movies?
Yes,
There's
yes.
There's a point at which Pippin and Merry are in a pub. And somebody brings, you know, this 20-ounce container of beer and sets it down, and Pippin says, "I didn't know it came in pipes." that's what the sporting news was like for me. You know, it was like, God, who knew? Well, yeah. All publications, nothing but baseball. Yeah, it was just amazing.
And
yeah,
you could
sit there at the barbershop and just leaf through these things. And they let me take their old issues home with me. It was really cool.
And you could spend hours reading through that. I want to talk about your first game, and then we'll talk about how the whole book came about. But it's, I think, 1959. I saw my first game in 1961. Saw the Yankees, probably some of the same guys that you saw in 1959.
Yeah.
You go to Comiskey Field. Talk about that experience, because I can remember going from a small town in Ohio to Detroit to watch the Tigers host the New York Yankees. I can remember that like it was a week ago. And recalling in your book, you obviously have that same vivid memory of that first baseball game.
Yeah, I mean, nothing can replace it, right?
Yes.
We rode with a friend. We didn't have a car. We rode with a friend to Dubuque, which was the nearest big town. And then got a train. These guys from my hometown, they chartered a train every summer. Who knew you could charter a train? and they would go into Chicago. So it was my first time ever on a train. And we get to Chicago, and, you know, half the guys are drunk already because they've been drinking
exactly,
all the way.
Exactly.
And we took a cab. First time I was ever in a cab to a restaurant in downtown Chicago where we ate. It was the first time I was ever allowed to order. And I made the mistake, which I didn't know was a mistake at the time, of ordering chicken, which wasn't really fully cooked. And my dad's memorable line was, "Stick to the beef, son." we were good. We were good Iowans. And then we took a bus, my first bus, to the ballpark, my first major league ballpark, and watched a doubleheader with the Yankees. Yogi Berra caught both ends of the doubleheader. He caught 18 innings.
I mean, that's amazing. Yeah, when you look at the Yankee roster back then, it's like a Hall of Fame roster. I mean, all of these names that jump out and you remember. And I can recall, in fact, you mentioned before the rhythm of a Latin Mass. For all the older boys that served Mass all summer, they got to go to a ball game, which is where I got to go. I served Mass every summer, got up at 6:30, rode my bike to go to the St. Richard's Catholic Church, and then got the reward of going to the ball game. I can remember walking in and seeing going up to the bleachers where we had our seats. Not the best seats, but who cared at that point?
Yeah.
Seeing the grass, I never saw grass that green in my life. Now, that was such a vivid memory.
True, isn't it? Yeah.
It was just
such a beautiful sight, and so I mean, there's nothing like it. I mean, it looks like nothing else.
Yeah.
The weird cutout, you know, the base paths.
And then you're
back then, Comiskey had picnic grounds under the right field bleachers. You could sit under the bleachers and have a picnic. It was really like going back in time.
Yeah, and you talk about you're there, you're at the tunnel, you're watching the guys come out, and you're thinking, these are like regular guys from back home. I thought they'd be giants when I saw them in person.
Yeah, we didn't even see them much on TV then. I mean, we just had one station, I think, and we'd only had TV for maybe 2 years or something. So you didn't have an appreciation for who they were. They were just normal-sized guys. And baseball players remain pretty normal-sized compared to other athletes.
Yes.
Basketball players or football players. You know, they're, I guess, golfers and tennis players. But team sports, baseball is the sport for the ordinary guy. Not that they're ordinary athletes. I mean, they're exquisite athletes. But they don't have to start out with a huge physical advantage to do it.
We're talking about the book,
yeah,
Off Speed, Baseball Pitching and the Art of Deception by Terry McDermott, our guest on the program, going through memories of why baseball is so important to so many people growing up with your father, and we'll talk about the impact it had on you as a father with your three daughters. Let's talk about how this whole book came about. And I mentioned the date, the perfect game, August 15th, 2012. But I understand this happened, the idea was planted, what, a couple of years before that, when you're watching this relief pitcher display what you called mulish obstinacy. Talk about that. What happened that day that you thought, you know, I really want to look into the subject a little bit more?
Yeah, well, I had moved to Southern California for a job and remained a Mariner fan, so followed them all the time and, you know, listened to the games on the internet and then watched them on the internet. And a friend of mine from Seattle came down to L.A. for the Mariners were playing the Angels for a three-game series. So he came down, so we go to the game, because we'd gotten a lot of games together in Seattle. So he came down, and the Mariners, you know, that year looked like they were going to actually maybe be a contender, which, as you might know, the Mariners' history is not one of contention.
Exactly, yes.
They've never been to a World Series. They haven't been to the playoffs in 15 years. But so he came down, and we went to the all three games of the three-game series, and Friday night they won. So we're feeling pretty good. We go back there Saturday afternoon, and you know, the game, so Felix Hernandez is pitching the game. And it's a 1-0 game. The Mariners are ahead, you know, and they go to the bullpen and bring in their closer, a guy named Brandon League. Brandon League is a curious fellow. He's an exceptionally good weapons. I mean, he throw a, you know, 96, 97, had just a killer split-finger pitch. And yet he would just get killed.
You know? Yes.
And you'd watch him, you say, how does anybody ever hit that guy? But then if you watched him enough, you realize why. He was so mechanical in his pitch selection. He never threw the splitter until he got two strikes. So every hitter in the world is sitting there looking fastball, just sitting dead red. And I quote Carl Willis, a longtime Major League pitching coach in the book, saying, look, I don't care if you throw 105, Major League hitters, if they know it's coming, they'll square it up. And it's absolutely true. And so they just sit there, just waiting, just sitting dead red. And sure enough, you know, it, bam, it's gone. Ties the ball game up, go to extra innings, and they get beat on a walk-off grand slam. And it's like, Jesus, why would a guy be that dumb? You know, I mean, what moves a pitcher to do that? So that was the question, right? How do pitchers do what they do? How do the good ones do it? You know, why don't they all do it that way?
Well, then you go back, and it's a fascinating look at the history of pitching, and I didn't realize this, but if you go back to, what, mid-19th century, basically the pitchers threw underhanded, and it was a hitter's ball game, and baseball games would last all day, literally.
Yeah, it was like coach pitch Little League. You know, the batter could say where he wanted the pitch thrown.
Amazing.
And the pitchers couldn't throw hard. They were forbidden. They couldn't break their wrist in a throwing motion. They had to just basically throw it like a softball, lob it. But as soon as they were able, the rules were changed to allow them to throw overhand, then all hell broke loose.
Exactly.
Ever since then, they've been looking for ways to fool hitters better. And it's kind of pitching kind of comes and goes in styles. It's like fashion. You know, for certain eras, a certain kind of pitch will be in fashion. Like right now, we're in the age of the cut fastball and the circle change, right? The cut fastball wasn't even heard of, you know, 25 years ago. And now it's a dominant pitch. You remember we had the whole split finger phase, Bruce Sutter and all those guys.
Yeah, you talk about that in the book. Yeah, that became the popular, what, the 1980s, and before that, people really never heard of it. All of a sudden, it's the one everybody's throwing.
Yeah, I remember Roger Craig, the pitching coach, every team he went to, he had every pitcher on the staff throwing it. And now you don't hear much about it. There's a few guys who throw it. You know, the Japanese pitchers all throw it. But it kind of came and went. And boy, for a while, nobody could hit them. I mean, you'd watch these games, it was just not fair. I remember talking to Elliot Johnson, who's a sort of a fringe major leaguer. He's dealt with several teams. And talking about the perfect game, he batted against Felix in that game. And talking about it, he says, and looking at the video of it, he says, you know, I know I look stupid, right? He says, look, I'm not going up there, you know, wanting to swing at balls in the dirt. You just don't know they're going to be in the dirt. You think they're going to be something else. It's hard enough to hit a baseball, right, when it's going straight.
Yes.
Think about the basic prospect of what a hitter has. He's got a piece of round wood that's about a yard long, and there's only about 5 square inches on the piece of round wood where you can hit the ball and have it go anywhere. Every place else it breaks the bat or it trickles off or something. It's a foul ball. And the pitcher's out there throwing 90 miles an hour or faster. You've got 0.4 of a second from the time the ball leaves the pitcher's hand until it crosses the plate. You have to decide to swing this piece of round wood 0.2 of a second after it's thrown. That's how long it takes you to blink your eyes, right? You have to decide then. So it's a wonder they ever hit it at all in some respects.
Yes.
And especially if the pitcher is trying to make the ball move in unexpected directions. It's an amazing, I mean, it's, you know, Ted Williams famously said that hitting a baseball is the hardest thing to do in sports. I don't know if that's true. I mean, I don't think I'd want to, you know, try to return Roger Federer's serve. It might hurt you.
Yes.
But there's no way you'd ever hit a major league pitch. I mean, if you stand next to a pitcher, I mean, really close, the ball makes a noise.
Yes.
You can't tell that when you watch it from the stands. A fastball, a major league fastball, makes a noise. But it's frightening. I mean, that's where Walter Johnson's nickname came from, Big Train. The fastball sounded like a train coming.
The book we're talking about is Off-Speed Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception by Terry McDermott. It's interesting as you give us the evolution of pitching and more pitches being added, how the art of deception really came into play and took over. And in that perfect game, you described it, as I said, as one of the greatest exhibitions of off-speed pitches ever put on. As the game went on, he was relying more and more on off-speed pitches. In fact, I think you total up at the end of the game, there were 24 swings and misses, and only like two of those were fastballs.
Yeah, I think the last 4 innings, he threw like 5 fastballs. Everything else was something crooked. He has his best pitch, his most effective and most feared pitch is his changeup, which he throws. It's not a changeup at all. He throws at 89 miles an hour. Yeah, you know, it's the fastest changeup probably in history.
Yes,
but it moves like a spitball. It just dives down into his right. Some of the changeups he threw in that game moved 2.5 feet. So how could you ever hit it? Well, all the hitters know that's what he throws. That's his pitch. So they're all trying to get him early in the count before he starts throwing it. So then, once they start doing that, then the hitter really is in a jam, because then he's going to start throwing the off-speed stuff, you know, first pitch. And once he starts mixing them up and the template of how he's throwing changes, the hitters are just completely defensive. They have no idea what's coming. It's weird, you know, most pitchers are taught to establish the fastball. And for one reason, if you don't have a fastball, you've got no off-speed. There's nothing to be off-speed of,
right?
If you can't throw the fastball. And, you know, if you can throw a fastball and you know where it's going, that's probably still the best pitch in the game. I mean, Greg Maddux, one of the best pitchers of the current era, you know, the last 50 years, almost never threw a curveball. He threw a cut fastball. He threw it at 88 miles an hour. And yet he was unhittable because he could throw it into a teacup. I mean, he just had superb control. You know, there are guys like that. I mean, Jamie Moyer is one of my favorite all-time pitchers. He was out of baseball, basically, or told he should get out of baseball when he was 30 years old. I think he'd won like 70 games or 60 games to that point. He was washed up. He won 150 games after that, or 200, I can't remember. And he threw an 84-mile-an-hour fastball. But he had a changeup that was just devastating. And he would throw it back to back to back. I asked him one time he's a little guy. He's a normal-sized guy. He's like 5'10". He weighs 165, 170 pounds. A really good athlete, but, you know, small. And I asked him if he wasn't just physically afraid to sit out there and throw an 80-mile-an-hour changeup to one of these big, strong hitters. And he was there in the middle of the steroid era. And he just kind of laughed. He says, you know, if it wasn't for the vanity of major league hitters, I would never have had a career at all. they're always sitting fastball. They're always sitting fastball. And that's what they're taught. You know, you look fastball and then react to off-speed. And so, you know, Moyer would strike guys out with his 84-mile-an-hour fastball. Weird.
That's amazing. And the pitchers that have been able to prolong their careers by going to something, you know, one of the off-speed pitches that you talk about. A couple minutes left in the program, going by too quickly. Terry McDermott, our guest on the program, an excellent book, Off-Speed, Baseball Pitching and the Art of Deception. You talk in the beginning about we have dressed the game in so many fine coats of so many glorious colors that it becomes hard to see the thing itself. Let's talk about that for a few minutes here at the end of the show and where baseball is today. What are we doing with baseball, and will it survive as how we remember it when we were growing up?
Well, you know, if you've been to a game lately, it's not like that anymore. There's more noise at the ballpark now than
yes.
I can stand. I don't want to be the old guy screaming at the kids, get off the lawn, but I just hate the racket that goes on all the time. What I really like about baseball, I think the reason it will persist, is that you don't, and people play it too slow. I go, well, that's fine. You don't have to pay attention. You know,
exactly.
Take a nap, have a beer, you know, have a conversation with your friend. You can tune me. I watch every pitch, but you don't have to.
Exactly.
It's an afternoon or a night at the ballpark. You know, it treated as such. That to me is its great joy, is that you don't have to be overwhelmed by it. The action of the game is spread out over several hours. Each action is separated by 50, 30, 40 seconds, something like that. There's a lot of time to be just in a community of like-minded people. And that's what I like about it. I mean, it's a thing that can bind people together, and you can have conversations. You can talk to your kids. You can explain the game to them, you know, if you don't let them have their cell phones. I think, you know, it's a great thing to still have. Something like that, some place you can go that is different from the kinetic, the hyperkinetic world that we live in, where everything moves at super fast speeds.
Yeah, if you go to a basketball game, if you go to a football game, those are fun, those are entertaining, but you really can't communicate with the people around you, family, friends, or people you don't even know that are sitting in front of you during the game. In baseball, you have that time to actually sit back and have a conversation and enjoy the game.
Yeah, right. It's very collegial. It's a social
yes.
sport in that regard. The park that my hometown park, Legion Field, was just, you know, a tiny little thing. Probably could seat maybe 800 people or something like that. And people would sit there and just like have a cup of coffee, you know, smile and talk. And it was just a night, you know, away from home. People used to drive their cars right up to the park. And watch it from their cars. If it was cold out, they'd get in their car and watch the game. That to me is, I guess that's a romantic view of it. But it's actually what the thing still is. I mean, you can still enjoy baseball that way.
Off-Speed, Baseball Pitching and the Art of Deception is the book we're talking about. Terry McDermott, the author, our guest on the program. Out of time, unfortunately. The book is an excellent read. It's available all across the country. History woven into the narrative of the perfect game, August 15th of 2012, Felix Hernandez. Interesting, as the game goes on, the reaction of the crowd, the reaction of people at the ballpark, people in Venezuela who are watching the game, they're actually interrupting the programming to follow the story of the perfect game. Terry, a pleasure having you on the program, an excellent book. It really brought back some memories of the early days growing up and watching and appreciating baseball. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Terry McDermott, our guest on the program. The book is called Off-Speed, Baseball Pitching and the Art of Deception, available all across the country. And, of course, you can link on to all the information about Terry's book at our website, thisweekinamerica.us. We're back after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.